Emergency pod. We got a settlement and all sorts of potential new rules that could shake up everything in college sports. Ross Dellinger explains.
Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
55 tumbling scholarships. Like, you know, again, yeah. 50 equestrians.
Yeah, right.
Ross Dellinger.
Instead of that Dan Wetzel, that 19-year-old Alabama football player signing the pizza deal with the Boosters pizza business, you'll just have the pizza boss send you a bag of cash.
And here's Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod, emergency pod from Paris, at least me. No Pat. The opening ceremonies just ended. I don't know where he is. Ross, though, is breaking news on this house settlement, potentially landmark day for how college athletics will work. So we thought, what the heck? Let's try to explain it in the simplest manner possible, particularly since I'm only partially up on it. But the gist of it. The NCAA and power conferences on Friday filed a 100-plus page long agreement in the settlement of three antitrust lawsuits, ushering a future of athlete revenue sharing, expanding scholarships to full rosters, and creating an historic enforcement system of arbitration overseen by the courts. The new concepts take effect at the start of the 2025-2026 academic year. The plaintiff's attorneys, representing thousands of athletes who brought the class action suits over athlete compensation or lack thereof, separately filed documents Friday detailing how they plan to distribute nearly $2.8 billion in back damages to former players over a 10-year period. And 83% of that money is going to go to football and men's basketball players, mostly from power conferences. Which is about 120 grand a year per player over a 10-year period. So, or 12,000 a year. I got it. So every year you play, you get 10 grand, 12 grand. All right. Ross Dellinger, you're all over this thing. Start with three or four of the bullet points. Don't go too deep. And then we'll come back and explain what these are.
It's it's a lot, obviously. Let's get to the bullet points. I think obviously the first one we've been knowing, right, is about the revenue share in the revenue pool. So each school will have in the low 20 millions to spend on their athletes in sharing revenue. And we got a little bit more about that bullet point, right? How that escalates, it'll go up. It'll probably be well above 25 million, you know, halfway through this 10-year deal.
And that's for the entire athletic department.
That is for the entire athletic department. The numbers bounce around, Dan, and we won't have the year one rev share cap until next year. But it'll be between 20 and 23 million for year one. So we also learned some other things about the cap that it will go up over the years, and then also we have learned some things about how they're trying to cut out collectives and boosters in third-party NIL payments by having some rules that basically prohibit that and having an enforcement mechanism that includes neutral arbitration. The court, you know, is over a lot of this. So that's number two. That was some interesting things there of trying to cut out the collectives. What else is there, Dan?
Rosters, the scholarship caps, which is
The third thing for sure. That's a big point. We discussed it a lot. I know in the pod, we finally have the list of the new roster limits. Basically, they're eliminating scholarship caps and replacing them with roster limits. So now schools are permitted to scholarship every player on a roster up into the roster cap. And some of these are huge growth numbers. Overall, of the 40-plus NCAA sports, there are 790, Dan, new scholarship spots created by all this. It's pretty pretty wild. And I'll just give you one example. Football settled at 105 as a roster limit. The previous scholarship limit on football was 85. So that's 20 more scholarships for football. So every sport has that. As much as 35 in men's lacrosse was added, to as low as zero added in women's basketball. The roster limit 35
in equestrian, too. Yeah.
35 in equestrian, yet track, 32 in men's track, 27 in women's track. Now, again, schools are permitted, right, to offer a full roster of scholarships. They're not required. So it's not a requirement. And obviously, every school is not going to completely fulfill their roster limit. But you will see, and this is why you will see athletic departments, maybe like yours out there, if you're a fan of whatever school, start to tier sports in their athletic department and invest in certain ones, pour money and resources in certain ones, move around staffing resources, move around scholarships and all that stuff. So you're going to see some of that. That's going to be an impact coming. All right, so
Let's start with this one. This was the one to me that's very interesting. I mean, look, the money's coming, all that. We'll get to the money. Why did they do this with these scholarships? Okay, so like they have a baseball team. They used to only give 11. They used to have 11.7 scholarships for the entire baseball team. And you would divvy it up to each kid. Maybe if you're a total stud, you got the full ride, but everyone else is getting partials and they did it. Now you can have 34 guys on the team, and they would have 34 guys, or they'd have more actually. But they would be getting partials. It'd be walk-ons. Now you can only have 34 guys, right?
That's right.
And they all can get a scholarship. Why was this appealing to these schools to do this?
Well, I don't know if it was appealing to the schools as much as it was appealing to attorneys and conference commissioners doing negotiations over the settlement. In order to progress in negotiations in order to hammer the settlement out, this was part of the deal. Plaintiffs' attorneys wanted scholarship limitations pulled. They wanted them eliminated. And part of the reason was eventually college leaders in the NCAA would probably get sued over that like they have everything else. They would get sued because it's an athlete restriction. So this was just part of the negotiation process to do this.
Think you're talking to a lot of people. We're going to get to the football aspect here. It won't change anything in basketball. You get two more scholarships or whatever in men's basketball. But a lot of times they don't even use all their scholarships. And we know in football, they often don't use all their, like, you know how, like, there's always that wave of, like, the walk-on gets a scholarship videos that everyone loves?
Yeah.
Do you think, though, this will lead to schools cutting sports? Because if I'm somehow obligated to, okay, I'm looking here, cross-country, 17 scholarships in men's and women's cross-country each, 34 scholarships for cross-country. If I'm obligated to do that, I guess I'm not obligated, but I might be. Like if a conference is going to, I just sit there and say, yeah, I don't want to spend 34 scholarships on a cross country team. That sport's going to get cut. You're going club. Like, could that be a result of this? Are you hearing that from the leaders you're talking to tonight?
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of this is, again, going back to the tiering of the sports, right? And the investing in certain ones and not investing in others.
So that's the term they're using, tiering?
Tiering sports, yeah. I think some ADs have even gone public with that. They've talked about it. I believe Ohio State their officials have mentioned about the tiering and investing in sports in a tiered manner. And so I think the low tier, you know, if you have three tiers in your athletic department. The top tiers, obviously the football and basketballs, the baseballs, depending on where you are. And then you have a second tier and a third tier.
So those tiers Ohio State, we're just using as an example, could say, we don't need a cross country team. We're just going to be, that's going to be a non-scholarship sport for us, conceivably.
Right. Or you just reduce it considerably, right? You reduce the scholarships considerably, the staffing. That is something definitely being talked about. You take those scholarships and staffing and you reroute them, right? You reroute them up to the top of your other tiers, right? Now that you can expand all these scholarships. That's something very seriously being discussed, I think, within college athletics.
Okay, so this is a legit threat to these sports. Because, I'm looking at these numbers, and I'm not trying to be negative, but, like, 55 tumbling scholarships, like, you know, again, 50 equestrians.
Yeah, right.
You know, really?
Yeah.
Do we need 34 scholarship track cross-country runners? It's a hell of a deal. It's a hell of a deal. You're getting a full ride. So, but I don't think anyone wants to see a sport go away. Look, there's always a rub on these things. There's always an ulterior motive when they're coming up with these things. And these numbers kind of are eye-popping.
A lot of it is about Title IX, right? It's about balancing Title IX because, you know, Dan, let's take, for instance, if you're going to see a lot of major college football programs, especially in the SEC and Big Ten, and they're going to fill their football roster, men's basketball roster, and at least some places in the SEC, their baseball roster,
right,
which is now 34, an additional 22. That's 22 plus 20 scholarships in football,
and two more in basketball,
plus three in basketball. So there's your roughly 45 additional men's scholarships. So you have to find 45 additional women's scholarships to add.
Or you drop your cross-country team. That helps.
Your men's team,
yeah, there's five
or something.
Goes,
yeah, and you exactly. So you'd reroute maybe not drop it completely, right? But you would send it, you would take scholarships potentially from those at the bottom of your tier, and you would move them up to football, baseball, basketball. Although even on the women's side, you might move some scholarships up from certain women's sports to softball, right? To volleyball, gymnastics, sports that have a following, get attendance, get ticket sales, and at least generate some kind of revenue, maybe not a profit, but a revenue.
All right. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how they deal with all this, because I don't know too many schools that can just sit there and add 790 scholarships. Or, you know, I mean, that's a lot of scholarships. We just added 500 athletes, all scholarship. That's a significant thing. Football-wise, if you can have 20 more scholarships, however, you're capped at 105 players. I'm trying to figure it out. I don't want to jump to a conclusion. Does that leave more talent at the top? Because obviously, like, if Ohio State's had 105 now, that's 20 more kids that are Ohio State full scholarship players. That's 20 less kids that would say, all right, I'm going to go play at the middle of the Big Ten.
That's right.
And it filters down. However, Ohio State might have 130 guys in its program right now. So there's actually 25 guys that are now actually more free to be anywhere. Does it balance out? Or is this my initial reaction is this will make it very difficult, not just for the Mid-American conferences and the Mountain West and stuff, but even the middle of the pack, right? You don't need Ryan Day running around with five more scholarships to offer each year. What are you hearing, or what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, for sure. I think, you know, every rule change that we've seen, Dan, over the last few years just grows the gap pretty much between a lot of the top of the sport, the blue bloods of the sport, and everybody else. And this is another one. There's a reason that the Big Ten and SEC recommended higher roster limits, specifically for football, 120 and I think 110, as opposed to the ACC, Big 12, and the G5, who are more in the 90 to 100 range. There's a reason for that, right? They basically settled in the middle, as close in the middle, I guess, as they could get at 105. But I think you're right. I think, you know, an extra 20 scholarships is an extra 20 players that are taken away from the middle of the Power Four. And then that's an extra 20 players, Dan, for the middle of the Power Four to take away from the G5.
Well, yeah.
And it goes down, right? It's probably a ripple effect. So there's 64
teams
all the way down.
Or the 64
It's 70 with Notre Dame.
70.
I think. 70.
That's 1,400 with Notre Dame. Players?
Not the best at math, so I'll leave you to that. But, you know, here's a note, though. Right now, it depends on where, but there are probably at least 10 and maybe 20 major college football programs who have a paid roster of at least 95, 100, maybe 105 players, right? Because the NIL collect, the walk-ons are not really walk-ons, right? They're getting paid tuition by the NIL collective, and that's happening quite a bit. Now you'll have it, right? You'll have the ability to officially offer scholarships. And then on top of that, Dan, offer rev share.
Right, now there'll be rev share, and that will be significant. Now, the thing is, you can only put so many guys on the court in the field. But this should, in recruiting-wise, I mean, that's 1,400 scholarships that are available that would go. And there's tiers in the Big Ten and there's tiers in the SEC. That's why I don't the last thing most of the Big Ten wants is Michigan and Ohio State with an extra 20 guys, because those 20 guys would have gone somewhere in their league. This is one that I think actually can affect. I mean, look, they'll tell you that NIL was bad for the competitive balance, but it wasn't. You sit in the middle of these leagues and you sit there and hope Alabama doesn't come an offer, right? It's not a committable offer when it's a real offer. Yep. Well, now they can grab five. Each school can get five more. This one's tough. I don't love this one. I don't love this one.
Going back to your original question about why they did this, right? With the roster limits and the scholarships. And, you know, I think it was years ago, I believe Steve Berman, one of the attorneys actually in this case, one of the plaintiff's attorneys, filed suit against the NCAA over walk-ons and over expanding scholarships and stuff like that. He didn't get it granted as a class action, I believe. But there was a sense during negotiations, I think, over the House settlement, that lawsuit was going to come again and get granted class action. And that was just going to be another lawsuit that the NCAA and the college conferences would have to deal with. So I think a part, maybe, I don't know if it was a make or break part of the negotiations, but I think plaintiff's attorneys got the message across to the defendants, the power conferences and the NCAA, that they needed to change the scholarship restrictions.
Yep.
And so basically in turn, we have, you know, almost 800 additional scholarships across all the sports. It's pretty wild. And I think like all the other rules that we've seen, a lot of them, it will continue to grow the gap between the richest, you know, programs in the country.
I prefer the no rules NIL. The Wild West is better than this. You want to be a women's wrestler, 30 scholarships in women's wrestling.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
I didn't know there was that many women's, probably not that many programs.
Well, Dan, let's talk about the Wild West.
The Wild West is working.
They're trying to shut it down.
Yeah.
Right there, as I said off the top, right, they're trying this lawsuit, this settlement. In the new policies around the settlement, the enforcement mechanism that's part of it, one of its big goals is to cut out booster-led collectives and the kind of, quote, phony deals that college leaders say that boosters are striking with their athletes. And the way they're doing that is requiring every NIL deal to be turned over to a clearinghouse and to vetted based on the standards of fair market value. If it fails to get approved through the clearinghouse, then the enforcement entity, which could be a third party or could still be the NCAA, that's still up in the air, could then make an athlete ineligible for competition or fine a school. And then if they appeal, there's an arbitration process. It's a neutral arbitrator who will be involved and rule on this in quicker fashion than the NCAA infractions system, Dan. According to the settlement, they have 45 days, the arbitrator to rule on this. And this is going to be a key thing that you'll see a lot of collectives, right? And maybe some boosters even speak out about, because I'll give you the scenario. If you are Dan Wetzel and you're a freshman football player at Alabama, and you sign a deal with a local pizza joint whose owner happens to be a booster of Alabama, and you have to turn that, before you take any money, you have to send that deal to the clearinghouse to get cleared, and it gets shot back because you're getting paid more than a fair market value for a 19, 20-year-old in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to market a pizza joint. That is going to be really interesting. Does that booster then turn around and, of course, sue? Or the player?
Probably.
Does the player sue?
The interest in controlling other people's money is just, it's like, it's the control factor that drives these things. This is going to be extremely hard to police. Clearing houses, and I'm going to determine what a fair market value is. Like, is it a fair market value to have football coaches fly around on private jets? Did anyone think that should have been nobody has to do this except, well, because they're so upset that there's this secret boogeyman out there, but then they're going to codify 20 more scholarships to the Alabama and Ohio State and think this is going to work. But at least it's on paper. It's their control. The NIL payments are not hurting anybody. I've read your summary of it. It's an excellent story. There's a bunch of excellent stories by Ross on this thing. It's just like, yeah, good luck. There's a special master. I mean, it's just like, you're just setting up this very difficult bureaucracy to try to do, when it's basically like, we're scared that someone's slipping some extra money to this thing. With a competitive, they should be shooting for competitive balance.
Well, and here's what I wonder what's going to happen. Also, Dan, is you're going to have potentially the old school way of cheating.
Right? Of course.
You'll instead of that Dan Wetzel, that 19-year-old Alabama football player signing the pizza deal with the booster's pizza business, you'll just have the pizza boss send you a bag of cash,
right?
And nobody's reporting nothing, right? And and there's no, or rarely no policing that, right? That's been happening for decades.
Yeah. Not a fan of this settlement. I think they just talk themselves into stuff, you know? Like, they just talk themselves into what's a problem. And I don't know. Then it comes to the money. 22%, I think you said, was going to be the salary cap, if you will, for an entire athletic department. Now, let's be clear. This has not been collectively bargained by the players. I understand there's a couple attorneys that say they represent all the players. They don't. Those attorneys, great guys, smart guys, are about to get an incredible windfall to settle this thing. You would never want an attorney that's got motivation to just get the settlement done to negotiate your future contractual situations. That's not a real good deal for the future athletes. So that level of, I don't see how that holds, that's the level of revenue sharing until there's actually gets collectively bargained. Like, this is a way to make it employment without employment. They just don't mm-hmm. want to have employment. They're trying to thread the needle and twist all these things into place.
Yeah. Well, I think eventually, right, we may get collective bargaining and get employment. It's actually in the settlement. It is included in the settlement. Just the possibility of collective bargaining, right, and employment happening. If it does happen, the settlement could actually be terminated.
Right.
So it is included in there. But one thing that you'll probably find pretty humorous, Dan, is the plaintiffs and their attorneys have agreed to assist the NCAA in lobbying efforts for congressional legislation to codify the settlement. And they have agreed also not to advocate against the NCAA on Capitol Hill, which they've done quite a bit. And then the third part of this, they've also agreed to take a neutral, quote, stance on employment. So there you go.
Yeah, they're standing down on this. A couple other interesting parts. I just don't know where they get the 22%. I don't know. It just doesn't. I haven't gone through all this stuff, but I don't know how that gets done without being collectively bargained. There is 4-year eligibility over 5 years. So, because we've always said what happens when a guy just keeps playing, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, it's kind of been interesting. And you must be pursuing a degree to participate in the revenue sharing, it says. Does that mean you, if you don't get paid, you don't even have to pursue the degree? You can be on the team?
Well, no, you've got to be a student. Right. That's what it's protecting
some kind of traditional 4-year thing, which I think right. most people would say is a positive.
Yeah.
So, what else are people who's excited when you're talking to them about it?
Not a ton of people. Everybody has kind of a gripe with this, but there are positives certainly. But everybody does have a gripe. I think if you speak to school administrators, they're still left because the settlement did not answer the question of how to distribute the revenue share and how Title IX is applied. So you have administrators that still have so many questions and are in a little bit painted into a corner when it comes to the distribution, because on one side, they need to probably file Title IX or get as close as they can to it, or they risk Title IX lawsuits. But on the other side, they want to pay enough competitively in a recruiting environment their football and men's basketball players, the players who generate the revenue in which they are sharing. So you have that piece, number one. Number two, I think if you go and speak to the players, right, themselves, and those who are kind of up on it and understand it, a lot of them and a lot of the kind of player advocates and union folks, association folks, will tell you that they're not sharing enough money, or they won't share enough money with the football and basketball players. So there's that. I think there's also players at the Olympic sport level. They've appeared in front of Congress, actually, during congressional hearings, Dan, saying, we don't like employment because of what it could do to Olympic sports. But if you look at the settlement, we talked about it earlier, and the new roster limits, that could be an issue for Olympic sports of moving around, cutting sports, but also moving around scholarships, de-investing in certain sports at the lower level, at the lower tier. But you know, there's probably a group of plaintiff lawyers who are quite happy. They have requested $500 million in attorney fees, and so not only that, but they, I think, view this, right, as a win for college athletes. They're going to get paid directly, and they're right on that, they would seem, but there are issues, certainly, within this settlement, and there are plenty of people who doubt that the NCAA can cut out the main thing here, the main kind of quote issue that's happening if you talk to college leaders, which is the involvement of boosters in collectives.
Yeah, this, like, circle back. I mean, look, they're at the same time they're saying we got to share at least 22% with our athletes, and that number is, it's not going lower. It's going to go up, and it may have to go up significantly if they actually get into collective bargaining. And at the same time they're saying all of these non-revenue sports now, if fully funded, cost more money because we have more scholarships, dramatically more scholarships. So the cost there went up. The revenue cut is going from 100% to, you know, whatever it's going to be, 78, you know, 70, mm-hmm. 65, whatever it's going to be. It just doesn't seem like it can work without cutting some of these sports. I don't find that to be a huge problem, because I think what you're looking at is what we've always done. Had this discussion with Olympic official USOC. Command just wasn't too popular. My pod stance isn't real popular with anybody. But, you know, Team USA has got, we're going to win a gazillion gold medals, right? Awesome. And they go, see, this is why we must preserve the old system of college sports, because we win these gold medals and all these teams, all these kids compete. And I said, that's great. But you asked college football players to fund the Olympic movement in our country. Like, that's, why are they doing it? Somebody should do it, I guess. Or if the people of the United States want it done, it should be government money. Or if this is really, because people are like, oh, it's great, we win the Olympics. Yeah, but who funded it? It's college football players made tons of money to create a whole bunch of sports on scholarship and the training and all of the stuff that we have, that athletes from all over the world come to the United States to train because our college system's so good. But it's all funded off of football players. They're saying, hey man, I want my share. Why should it only be 22%? So I don't see how this is good for Olympic sports. The math is going to work on this. And then really my main concern is competitive balance, particularly not just between Power Five and Group of Five, but within the Power Five, because it can very quickly become, you just don't even stand a chance if you're at the bottom of those kids. You know, if you just sit there in a Big Ten and say Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, generally when they recruit, they get the guys they want. And it's even Ohio State over the other two, right? Like Minnesota can't really beat those three schools for a player. And now there's 60 less guys, right? It's just that's, I don't see how that is in any way a really a positive thing for what I care about, which is a whole bunch of teams being able to have really good competitive balance.
You know, I think another part of this we haven't mentioned is that this isn't, you know, kind of an opt-in, opt-out situation. Schools that are not defendants, so Group of Five, FCS, non-football playing Division I schools, they could opt out and not share revenue with athletes. But if they decide to share revenue with athletes, they have to opt into the whole thing, which means the roster limits, right? It means the employee.
How many schools do you think are really going to opt out?
Probably very few. Just from talking to folks, probably very few. I was at the, I think we talked, I was in Naples, Dan, remember the Ritz-Carlton on the beach in Naples for the conference.
I didn't see anything in there about cutting meeting, Ritz-Carlton stays. That wasn't in the settlement.
But
mandatory three stays a year.
Division One breaks down about 130 FBS schools. Mm-hmm. I think another 100 FCS, and then right around maybe 90 to 100 non-football playing schools. I think there are a decent amount of non-football playing. I would be curious that may opt out of the settlement. I think that's a possibility, and that's some stuff that I heard, you know, in Naples from those commissioners. Where, hey, our schools, they can't afford, you know, they certainly can't afford $22 million, right, of revenue share. They can't afford $2 million, and so we're not going to do this. You know,
would those teams be able to compete in like the NCAA basketball tournament?
Great question. You will find a split on that. When you ask
the
that
Ivy
question
League offers no scholarships, right?
You know,
famously, there are no athletic scholarships to the Ivy League, but they're allowed to compete in all of the championships, and they sometimes win them. Like, they still do well in certain sports.
No, I think that's the beauty of college sports, right? Is the little guy getting a chance to compete against those high resource programs. While it's the beauty, it's also the downfall. Maybe, I mean, all these court cases are partly because of the NCAA rules that legislate competitive equity and try to keep everybody even. So it restrains and restricts athlete compensation. And that's what's gotten us into this in the first place. So the beauty of college sports, maybe it's
coming
also
back to
the downfall a little bit here. But Dan, if you talk to some power conference leaders, they will say no. The schools that choose to not opt in should not be able to participate in championships with the others who do. But I don't know that enough people agree to that for that to happen. It's certainly something that'll be a conversation the next few months until this is implemented, which will be the start of the next academic year, 2025-26. So summer, fall of 25, this will start.
All right. It's a pretty good breakdown.
Yeah.
Momentous day, potentially. A lot of concerns. A lot of questions. Let's see how this all falls out. Guys are all going to wish they're going to want their no guardrails back. Going to want their no guardrails back. Mark my words. Guardrails are getting them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You got anything else? Mm-hmm. Pat obviously couldn't be here. I didn't even respond to our text. He has the smallest hotel room in Paris. He literally has nowhere to tape a podcast. The room is too small to podcast. Mm-hmm. That's a small room, Ross.
It is.
You saw the pic.
It is a small room. I did.
Yeah, I think.
I did see the pic.
He's in La Broom Closette, room 318 or something. Yes. I don't know. But actually, he's probably getting a good night's sleep because he's got a big swimming. He'll be at the swimming nonstop.
Of course.
Geeks out on the swimming. He's very excited for swimming. Did you watch the opening ceremony?
I did not. I was busy riding away on all this lovely settlement stuff.
Yeah, me neither.
You asked if I had anything else, Dan. There's something we discussed. You know, it gets a little in the weeds, but we've discussed it on the pod before, and that is these collectives evolving into marketing agencies where schools are sending money directly to the marketing agencies, right? And then they're distributing that money to athletes. It's a way to get the money out from underneath the school umbrella. And that's happening at a lot of places. According to the settlement, that can continue to happen, but that money, because it is institutional money, will be counted toward the cap, number one. And number two, all those deals that this collective or marketing agency does with athletes must run through the clearinghouse and be authentic. So it's going to make it more
difficult. They're definitely creating plenty of jobs, bureaucratic jobs to oversight. Got to keep those compliance departments in business. All our friends in compliance.
Yep.
Schools are going to need like 20 guys working at the compliance department. And not more. Mm-hmm. I don't know. All right. So in recap, how should your average fan feel about this?
I'm going to use an example of a friend of mine who graduated from, I would say, a mid to lower tier power conference school and basically texted me yesterday. Just like three words, we are effed. And I think it speaks to what you said, the gap between the top, I don't know, 15, 20, maybe 30 programs in college football will grow between them and everybody else will grow with not just revenue sharing, but now with the roster limits. So the more you
know, it's finally, the more you finally evening a little bit.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but the more you uncuff,
I know,
right? The top programs and allow them to spend the money they have, the more that gap will grow. The days of the competitive equity are over, and it's the reason I said what I said earlier. It's part of the beauty with the little guy in college athletics, but it's also because of the competitive equity rules that violate antitrust. It's part of the downfall. So it depends on where you're a fan of. Dan, if you're a fan of Alabama, this is probably pretty good, right? If you're a fan of Texas, this is pretty good. If you're a fan of Arkansas, if you're a fan of NC State, you know, if you're those fans, it's probably not great. Because you're that mid to lower tier of the power level that might see recruits that probably used to come to your school now have more spots to go to others and get paid more in revenue sharing potentially, you know. But at the same time of all that, Dan, the revenue sharing does have the cap.
Yeah.
And if they can police the cap enough, you would think it would have some way of evening out. But the big question looms is this arbitration, this new arbitration that will basically be in the appeals process for deals that are kicked out of the clearinghouse. Will this arbitrator have subpoena power?
Yeah.
We don't know that yet.
Also, you know, I mean, it's still about playing time and opportunity and stuff like that. And
correct.
The transfer portal
yeah.
allows so much more freedom of movement. If they didn't have transfer portal, which I think has been a very mixed bag, but if it was mm-hmm. just you're signed in and you're linked up here, like if it was just high school recruiting, this would be devastating. 20 more scholarships is a big number. But the fact the guys can move around so easily, they will find their spot. But, you know, those big schools can stash more guys. All right. I think we covered it all. We'll be back Monday with a normal show. We'll have a people's court and all that. Be a little more frivolous. We'll make fun of Pat more. But Ross, great work. You're a leader on this subject. And I think our audience would like a detailed synopsis of what the hell is going on. So mm-hmm. appreciate it. Thank you all for listening. And we'll talk to you later. And go Team USA. We can all root for them, I guess. Unless you want to root for someone else. Mm-hmm. See you later.